Chapter 6 Gilderoy Lockhart. The next day, however, Harry barely grinned once. Things started to go downhill from breakfast in the great hall. The four long-house tables were laden with tureens of porridge, plates of kippers, mountains of toast, and dishes of eggs and bacon beneath the enchanted ceiling, today a dull, cloudy grey. Harry and Ron sat down at the Gryffindor table next to Hermione, who had her copy of Voyages with Vampires propped open against a milk jug. There was a slight stiffness in the way she said, "Morning," which told Harry that she was still disapproving of the way they had arrived. Neville Longbottom, on the other hand, greeted them cheerfully. Neville was a round-faced and accident-prone boy with the worst memory of anyone Harry had ever met. "Post's due any minute. I think Gran's sending on a few things I forgot." Harry had only just started his porridge when, sure enough, there was a rushing sound overhead, and 100 or so owls streamed in, circling the hall and dropping letters and packages into the chattering crowd. A big, lumpy parcel bounced off Neville's head, and a second later something large and grey fell into Hermione's jug, spraying them all with milk and feathers. "Errol!" said Ron, pulling the bedraggled owl out by the feet. Errol slumped unconscious onto the table, his legs in the air and a damp red envelope in his beak. "Oh, no!" Ron gasped.
"It's all right. He's still alive," said Hermione, prodding Errol gently with the tip of her finger.
"It's not that. It's that!" Ron was pointing at the red envelope. It looked quite ordinary to Harry, but Ron and Neville were both looking at it as though they expected it to explode.
"What's the matter?" said Harry.
"She's sent me a howler," said Ron faintly.
"You'd better open it, Ron," said Neville in a timid whisper. "It'll be worse if you don't. My gran sent me one once, and I ignored it and—"
He gulped.
"It was horrible."
Harry looked from their petrified faces to the red envelope.
"What's a howler?" he said.
But Ron's whole attention was fixed on the letter, which had begun to smoke at the corners.
"Open it!" Neville urged. "It'll all be over in a few minutes."
Ron stretched out a shaking hand, eased the envelope from Errol's beak, and slit it open. Neville stuffed his fingers in his ears. A split second later, Harry knew why. He thought for a moment it had exploded. A roar of sound filled the huge hall, shaking dust from the ceiling.
"Stealing the car! I wouldn't have been surprised if they'd expelled you! You wait till I get hold of you! I don't suppose you stop to think what your father and I went through when we saw it had gone!"
Mrs. Weasley's yells, 100 times louder than usual, made the plates and spoons rattle on the table and echoed deafeningly off the stone walls. People throughout the hall were swivelling around to see who had received the howler, and Ron sank so low in his chair that only his crimson forehead could be seen.
"Letter from Dumbledore last night! I thought your father would die of shame! We didn't bring you up to behave like this! You and Harry could both have died!"
Harry had been wondering when his name was going to crop up. He tried very hard to look as though he couldn't hear the voice that was making his eardrums throb.
"Absolutely disgusted! Your father's facing an inquiry at work! It's entirely your fault! And if you put another toe out of line, we'll bring you straight back home!"
A ringing silence fell. The red envelope, which had dropped from Ron's hand, burst into flames and curled into ashes. Harry and Ron sat stunned, as though a tidal wave had just passed over them. A few people laughed, and gradually a babble of talk broke out again. Hermione closed Voyages with Vampires and looked down at the top of Ron's head.
"Well, I don't know what you expected, Ron, but you—"
"Don't tell me I deserved it," snapped Ron. Harry pushed his porridge away. His insides were burning with guilt. Mr. Weasley was facing an inquiry at work. after all Mr. and Mrs. Weasley had done for him over the summer. But he had no time to dwell on this. Professor McGonagall was moving along the Gryffindor table, handing out timetables. Harry took his and saw that they had double herbology with the Hufflepuffs first. Harry, Ron and Hermione left the castle together, crossed the vegetable patch and made for the greenhouses, where the magical plants were kept. At least the Howler had done one good thing. Hermione seemed to think they had now been punished enough and was being perfectly friendly again. As they neared the greenhouses, they saw the rest of the class standing outside, waiting for Professor Sprout. Harry, Ron and Hermione had only just joined them when she came striding into view across the lawn, accompanied by Gilderoy Lockhart. Professor Sprout's arms were full of bandages, and with another twinge of guilt, Harry spotted the whomping willow in the distance, several of its branches now in slings. Professor Sprout was a squat little witch who wore a patched hat over her flyaway hair. There was usually a large amount of earth on her clothes, and her fingernails would have made Aunt Petunia faint. Gilderoy Lockhart, however, was immaculate in sweeping robes of turquoise, his golden hair shining under a perfectly positioned turquoise hat with gold trimming. "Oh, hello there!" Lockhart called, beaming around at the assembled students. "Just been showing Professor Sprout the right way to doctor a whomping willow. But I don't want you running away with the idea that I'm better at herbology than she is. I just happen to have met several of these exotic plants on my travels."
"Greenhouse 3 today, chaps," said Professor Sprout, who was looking distinctly disgruntled, not at all her usual cheerful self.
There was a murmur of interest. They had only ever worked in Greenhouse 1 before. Greenhouse 3 housed far more interesting and dangerous plants. Professor Sprout took a large key from her belt and unlocked the door. Harry caught a whiff of damp earth and fertilizer mingling with the heavy perfume of some giant umbrella-sized flowers dangling from the ceiling. He was about to follow Ron and Hermione inside when Lockhart's hand shot out.
"Harry, I've been wanting a word. You don't mind if he's a couple of minutes late, do you, Professor Sprout?"
Judging by Professor Sprout's scowl, she did mind, but Lockhart said,
"That's the ticket,"
and closed the greenhouse door in her face.
"Harry," said Lockhart, his large white teeth gleaming in the sunlight as he shook his head. "Harry, Harry, Harry."
Completely nonplussed, Harry said nothing.
"When I heard, well, of course, it was all my fault. Could have kicked myself."
Harry had no idea what he was talking about. He was about to say so when Lockhart went on.
"Don't know when I've been more shocked. Flying a car to Hogwarts. Well, of course, I knew at once why he had done it. Stood out a mile. Harry, Harry, Harry."
It was remarkable how he could show every one of those brilliant teeth, even when he wasn't talking.
"Gave you a taste for publicity, didn't I?" said Lockhart. "Gave you the bug, You got onto the front page of the paper with me, and you couldn't wait to do it again."
"Oh, no, Professor. See,
Harry, Harry, Harry," said Lockhart, reaching out and grasping his shoulder. "I understand. Natural to want a bit more once you've had that first taste. And I blame myself for giving you that, because it was bound to go to your head. But see here, young man, you can't start flying cars to try and get yourself noticed. Just calm down, all right? Plenty of time for all that when you're older. Yes, yes, I know what you're thinking. It's all right for him. He's an internationally famous wizard already.
But when I was 12... I was just as much of a nobody as you are now. In fact, I'd say I was even more of a nobody. I mean, a few people have heard of you, haven't they?
All that business with the he who must not be named."
He glanced at the lightning scar on Harry's forehead.
"I know. I know, it's not quite as good as winning Witch Weekly's Most Charming Smile Award 5 times in a row as I have. But it's a start, Harry. To start."
He gave Harry a hearty wink and strode off. Harry stood stunned for a few seconds. Then, remembering he was supposed to be in the greenhouse, he opened the door and slid inside. Professor Sprout was standing behind a trestle bench in the centre of the greenhouse. About 20 pairs of different coloured ear muffs were lying on the bench. When Harry had taken his place between Ron and Hermione, she said,
"We'll be repotting mandrakes today. Now, who can tell me the properties of the mandrake?"
To nobody's surprise, Hermione's hand was first into the air.
"Mandrake, or mandragora, is a powerful restorative," said Hermione,
sounding as usual as though she had swallowed the textbook.
"It is used to return people who have been transfigured or cursed to their original state." "Excellent. 10 points to Gryffindor," said Professor Sprout. "The mandrake forms an essential part of most antidotes. It is also, however, dangerous. Who can tell me why?"
Hermione's hand narrowly missed Harry's glasses as it shot up again.
"The cry of the mandrake is fatal to anyone who hears it," she said promptly. "Precisely. Take another 10 points," said Professor Sprout. "Now, the mandrakes we have here are still very young."
She pointed to a row of deep trays as she spoke, and everyone shuffled forward for a better look. 100 or so tufty little plants, purplish-green in colour, were growing there in rows. They looked quite unremarkable to Harry, who didn't have the slightest idea what Hermione meant by the cry of the mandrake.
"Everyone take a pair of earmuffs," said Professor Sprout.
There was a scramble as everyone tried to seize a pair that wasn't pink and fluffy.
"When I tell you to put them on, make sure your ears are completely covered," said Professor Sprout. "When it is safe to remove them, I will give you the thumbs up. Right. Earmuffs on!"
Harry snapped the earmuffs over his ears. They shut out sound completely. Professor Sprout put a pink fluffy pair over her own ears, rolled up the sleeves of her robes, grasped one of the tufty plants firmly, and pulled hard. Harry let out a gasp of surprise that no one could hear. Instead of roots, a small, muddy, and extremely ugly baby popped out of the earth. The leaves were growing right out of his head. He had pale green, mottled skin, and was clearly bawling at the top of his lungs. Professor Sprout took a large plant pot from under the table and plunged the mandrake into it, burying him in dark, damp compost until only the tufted leaves were visible. Professor Sprout dusted off her hands, gave them all the thumbs up, and removed her own earmuffs.
"As our mandrakes are only seedlings, their cries won't kill yet," she said calmly, as though she had just done nothing more exciting than water a begonia. "However, they will knock you out for several hours, and as I'm sure none of you want to miss your first day back, make sure your earmuffs are securely in place while you work. I will attract your attention when it is time to pack up. 4 to a tray. There is a large supply of pots here, compost in the sacks over there, and be careful of the venomous tentacula. It's teething."
She gave a sharp slap to a spiky dark red plant as she spoke, making it draw in the long feelers that had been inching sneakily over her shoulder. Harry, Ron, and Hermione were joined at their tray by a curly-haired Hufflepuff boy Harry knew by sight but had never spoken to.
"Justin Finch Fletchley," he said brightly, shaking Harry by the hand. "Know who you are, of course, the famous Harry Potter. And you're Hermione Granger, always top in everything."
Hermione beamed as she had her hand shaken too.
"And Ron Weasley. Wasn't that your flying car?"
Ron didn't smile. The howler was obviously still on his mind.
"That Lockhart's something, isn't he?" said Justin happily,
as they began filling their plant pots with dragon dung compost.
"Awfully brave chap. Have you read his books? I'd have died of fear if I'd been cornered in a telephone box by a werewolf, but he stayed cool and zap! Just fantastic. My name was down for Eton, you know. I can't tell you how glad I am I came here instead. Of course, Mother was slightly disappointed, but since I made her read Lockhart's books, I think she's begun to see how useful it'll be to have a fully trained wizard in the family."
After that, they didn't have much chance to talk. Their earmuffs were back on, and they needed to concentrate on the mandrakes. Professor Sprout had made it look extremely easy, but it wasn't. The mandrakes didn't like coming out of the earth, but didn't seem to want to go back into it either.
They squirmed, kicked, flailed their sharp little fists, and gnashed their teeth. Harry spent 10 whole minutes trying to squash a particularly fat one into a pot. By the end of the class, Harry, like everyone else, was sweaty, aching, and covered in earth. They traipsed back to the castle for a quick wash, and then the Gryffindors hurried off to Transfiguration. Professor McGonagall's classes were always hard work, but today was especially difficult. Everything Harry had learned last year seemed to have leaked out of his head during the summer. He was supposed to be turning a beetle into a button, but all he managed to do was give his beetle a lot of exercise as it scuttled over the desktop, avoiding his wand. Ron was having far worse problems. He had patched up his wand with some borrowed Spello tape, but it seemed to be damaged beyond repair. It kept crackling and sparking at odd moments, and every time Ron tried to transfigure his beetle, it engulfed him in thick grey smoke which smelled of rotten eggs. Unable to see what he was doing, Ron accidentally squashed his beetle with his elbow and had to ask for a new one. Professor McGonagall wasn't pleased. Harry was relieved to hear the lunch bell. His brain felt like a wrung sponge. Everyone filed out of the classroom except him and Ron, who was whacking his wand furiously on the desk. "Stupid, useless thing!" "Write home for another one," Harry suggested, as the wand let off a volley of bangs like a firecracker. "Oh, yeah, and get another howler back," said Ron, stuffing the now hissing wand into his back. "It's your own fault your wand got snapped!" They went down to lunch, where Ron's mood was not improved by Hermione showing them the handful of perfect coat buttons she had produced in Transfiguration. "What have we got this afternoon?" said Harry, hastily changing the subject. "Defence against the Dark Arts," said Hermione at once. "Why," demanded Ron, seizing her timetable, "have you outlined all Lockhart's lessons in little hearts?" Hermione snatched the timetable back, flushing furiously. They finished lunch and went outside into the overcast courtyard. Hermione sat down on a stone step and buried her nose in Voyages with Vampires again. Harry and Ron stood talking about Quidditch for several minutes before Harry became aware that he was being closely watched. Looking up, he saw the very small, mousy-haired boy he had seen trying on the sorting hat last night, staring at Harry as though transfixed. He was clutching what looked like an ordinary muggle camera, and the moment Harry looked at him, he went bright red.
"All right, Harry, I'm Colin Creevy," he said breathlessly, taking a tentative step forward. "I'm in Gryffindor too. Do you think, would it be all right if... can I have a picture?"
he said, raising the camera, hopefully. "A picture?" Harry repeated blankly.
"So I can prove I've met you," said Colin Creevy eagerly, edging further forward. "I know all about you. Everyone's told me about how you survived when... you-know-who tried to kill you, and how he disappeared and everything, and how you've still got a lightning scar on your forehead."
His eyes raked Harry's hairline.
"And a boy in my dormitory said, if I develop the film in the right potion, the pictures'll move."
Colin drew a great shuddering breath of excitement and said,
"It's brilliant here, isn't it? I never knew all the odd stuff I could do was magic till I got the letter from Hogwarts. My dad's a milkman. He couldn't believe it either. So I'm taking loads of pictures to send home to him. And it'd be really good if I had one of you."
He looked imploringly at Harry.
"Maybe your friend could take it and I could stand next to you. And then could you sign it?"
"Signed photos? You're giving out signed photos, Potter?"
Loud and scathing, Draco Malfoy's voice echoed around the courtyard. He had stopped right behind Colin, flanked, as he always was at Hogwarts, by his large and thuggish cronies, Crabbe and Goyle.
"Everyone queue up!" Malfoy roared to the crowd. "Harry Potter's giving out signed photos!"
"No, I'm not!" said Harry angrily, his fists clenching. "Shut up, Malfoy!"
"You're just jealous!"
piped up Colin, whose entire body was about as thick as Crabbe's neck.
"Jealous!" said Malfoy, who didn't need to shout any more.
Half the courtyard was listening in.
"Of what?" I don't want a foul scar right across my head, thanks. I don't think getting your head cut open makes you that special myself. Crabbe and Goyle were sniggering stupidly. Eat slugs, Malfoy, said Ron angrily. Crabbe stopped laughing and started rubbing his conker-like knuckles in a menacing way. Be careful, Weasley, sneered Malfoy. You don't want to start any trouble, or your mummy'll have to come and take you away from school. He put on a shrill, piercing voice.
If you put another toe out of line...
A knot of Slytherin fifth-years nearby laughed loudly at this. Weasley would like a signed photo, Potter, smirked Malfoy. It'd be worth more than his family's whole house. Ron whipped out his spellotaped wand, but Hermione shut Voyages with Vampires with a snap and whispered, "Look out!" "What's all this? What's all this?" Gilderoy Lockhart was striding towards them, his turquoise robes swirling behind him. "Who's giving out signed photos?" Harry started to speak, but he was cut short as Lockhart flung an arm around his shoulders and thundered jovially, "Shouldn't have asked. We meet again, Harry." Pinned to Lockhart's side and burning with humiliation, Harry saw Malfoy slide smirking back into the crowd. "Come on then, Mr. Creevy," said Lockhart, beaming at Colin. "A double portrait, can't say fairer than that, and we'll both sign it for you." Colin fumbled for his camera and took the picture as the bell rang behind them, signalling the start of afternoon classes. "Off you go, move along there," Lockhart called to the crowd, and he set off back to the castle with Harry, who was wishing he knew a good vanishing spell, still clasped to his side. "A word to the wise, Harry," said Lockhart paternally as they entered the building through a side door. "I covered up for you back there with young Creevy. If he was photographing me, too, your schoolfellows won't think you're setting yourself up so much." Deaf to Harry's stammers, Lockhart swept him down a corridor lined with staring students and up a staircase. "Let me just say that handing out signed pictures at this stage of your career isn't sensible. Looks a tad big-headed, Harry, to be frank. There may well come a time when, like me, you'll need to keep a stack handy wherever you go, but..." He gave a little chortle. "I don't think you're quite there yet." They had reached Lockhart's classroom, and he let Harry go at last. Harry yanked his robes straight and headed for a seat at the very back of the class, where he busied himself with piling all seven of Lockhart's books in front of him so that he could avoid looking at the real thing. The rest of the class came clattering in, and Ron and Hermione sat down on either side of Harry. "You could have fried an egg on your face," said Ron. "You'd better hope Creevy doesn't meet Ginny. They'll be starting a Harry Potter fan club." "Shut up," snapped Harry. The last thing he needed was for Lockhart to hear the phrase "Harry Potter fan club." When the whole class was seated, Lockhart cleared his throat loudly, and silence fell. He reached forward, picked up Neville Longbottom's copy of Travels with Trolls, and held it up to show his own winking portrait on the front. "Me," he said, pointing at it and winking as well. "Gilderoy Lockhart, Order of Merlin, third class, honorary member of the Dark Force Defence League, and 5 times winner of Witch Weekly's Most Charming Smile Award. But I don't talk about that. I didn't get rid of the band on Banshee by smiling at her." He waited for them to laugh. A few people smiled weakly. "I see you've all bought a complete set of my books. Well done. I thought we'd start today with a little quiz. Nothing to worry about, just to check how well you've read them, how much you've taken in." When he had handed out the test papers, he returned to the front of the class and said, "You have 30 minutes. Start now." Harry looked down at his paper and read, 1. What is Gilderoy Lockhart's favourite colour? 2. What is Gilderoy Lockhart's secret ambition? 3. What, in your opinion, is Gilderoy Lockhart's greatest achievement to date? On and on it went, over 3 sides of paper, right down to 54. When is Gilderoy Lockhart's birthday?
and what would his ideal gift be? Half an hour later, Lockhart collected in the papers and rifled through them in front of the class. "Hardly any of you remembered that my favourite colour is lilac. I say so in Year with a Yeti. And a few of you need to read Weekend with a Werewolf more carefully. I clearly state in Chapter 12 that my ideal birthday gift would be harmony between all magic and non-magic peoples, though I wouldn't say no to a large bottle of Ogden's Old Fire Whiskey." He gave them another roguish wink. Ron was now staring at Lockhart with an expression of disbelief on his face. Seamus Finnegan and Dean Thomas, who were sitting in front, were shaking with silent laughter. Hermione, on the other hand, was listening to Lockhart with rapt attention, and gave a start when he mentioned her name. "But Miss Hermione Granger knew my secret ambition is to rid the world of evil and market my own range of hair care potions. Good girl. In fact," he flipped her paper over, "full marks. Where is Miss Hermione Granger?" Hermione raised a trembling hand. "Excellent," beamed Lockhart. "Quite excellent. Take 10 points for Gryffindor. And so, to business." He bent down behind his desk and lifted a large covered cage onto it. "Now, be warned. It is my job to arm you against the foulest creatures known to wizard kind. You may find yourselves facing your worst fears in this room. Know only that no harm can befall you whilst I am here. All I ask is that you remain calm." In spite of himself, Harry leaned around his pile of books for a better look at the cage. Lockhart placed a hand on the cover. Dean and Seamus had stopped laughing now. Neville was cowering in his front row seat. "I must ask you not to scream," said Lockhart in a low voice. "It might provoke them." As the whole class held its breath, Lockhart whipped off the cover. "Yes," he said dramatically. "Freshly caught Cornish pixies!" Seamus Finnegan couldn't control himself. He let out a snort of laughter, which even Lockhart couldn't mistake for a scream of terror. "Yes," he smiled at Seamus.
"Well, they're not very dangerous, are they?" Seamus choked.
"Don't be so sure," said Lockhart, waggling a finger annoyingly at Seamus. "Devilish tricky little blighters they can be." The pixies were electric blue and about 8 inches high, with pointed faces and voices so shrill it was like listening to a lot of budgies arguing. The moment the cover had been removed, they had started jabbering and rocketing around, rattling the bars and pulling bizarre faces at the people nearest them. "Right then," Lockhart said loudly, "let's see what you make of them." And he opened the cage. It was pandemonium. The pixies shot in every direction like rockets. Two of them seized Neville by the ears and lifted him into the air. Several shot straight through the window, showering the back row with broken glass. The rest proceeded to wreck the classroom more effectively than a rampaging rhino. They grabbed ink bottles and sprayed the class with them, shredded books and papers, tore pictures from the walls, upended the waste bin, grabbed bags and books, and threw them out of the smashed window. Within minutes, half the class was sheltering under desks, and Neville was swinging from the candelabra in the ceiling. "Come on now, round them up, round them up! They're only pixies," Lockhart shouted. He rolled up his sleeves, brandished his wand, and bellowed, "Pesky pixie, pestodomi!" It had absolutely no effect. One of the pixies seized Lockhart's wand and threw it out of the window too. Lockhart gulped and dived under his own desk, narrowly avoiding being squashed by Neville, who fell a second later as the candelabra gave way. The bell rang, and there was a mad rush towards the exit. In the relative calm that followed, Lockhart straightened up, caught sight of Harry, Ron and Hermione, who were almost at the door, and said, "Well, I'll ask you three to just nip the rest of them back into their cage." He swept past them and shut the door quickly behind him.
"Can you believe him?" roared Ron, as one of the remaining pixies bit him painfully on the ear. "He just wants to give us some hands-on experience," said Hermione, immobilizing two pixies at once with a clever freezing charm and stuffing them back into their cage. "Hands-on," said Harry, who was trying to grab a pixie dancing out of reach with its tongue out. "Hermione, he didn't have a clue what he was doing."
"Rubbish," said Hermione. "You've read his books. Look at all those amazing things he's done."
"He says he's done," Ron muttered. Chapter 7 Mudbloods and Murmurs. Harry spent a lot of time over the next few days dodging out of sight whenever he saw Gilderoy Lockhart coming down a corridor. Harder to avoid was Colin Creevy, who seemed to have memorized Harry's timetable. Nothing seemed to give Colin a bigger thrill than to say, "All right, Harry," 6 or 7 times a day, and hear, "Hello, Colin, back," however exasperated Harry sounded when he said it. Hedwig was still angry with Harry about the disastrous car journey, and Ron's wand was still malfunctioning, surpassing itself on Friday morning by shooting out of Ron's hand in charms and hitting tiny old Professor Flitwick squarely between the eyes, creating a large, throbbing green boil where it had struck. So, with one thing and another, Harry was quite glad to reach the weekend. He, Ron, and Hermione were planning to visit Hagrid on Saturday morning. Harry, however, was shaken awake several hours earlier than he would have liked by Oliver Wood, captain of the Gryffindor Quidditch team.
"What's the matter?" said Harry groggily.
"Quidditch practice," said Wood. "Come on."
Harry squinted at the window. There was a thin mist hanging across the pink and gold sky. Now he was awake, he couldn't understand how he could have slept through the racket the birds were making.
"Oliver," Harry croaked. "It's the crack of dawn."
"Exactly," said Wood.
He was a tall and burly sixth year, and at the moment his eyes were gleaming with a mad enthusiasm.
"It's part of our new training program. Come on, grab your broom and let's go," said Wood heartily. "None of the other teams have started training yet. We're going to be the first off the mark this year."
Yawning and shivering slightly, Harry climbed out of bed and tried to find his Quidditch robes.
"Good man," said Wood. "Meet you on the pitch in 15 minutes.
When he'd found his scarlet team robes and pulled on his cloak for warmth, Harry scribbled a note to Ron, explaining where he'd gone, and went down the spiral staircase to the common room, his Nimbus 2000 on his shoulder. He had just reached the portrait hole when there was a clatter behind him, and Colin Creevy came dashing down the spiral staircase, his camera swinging madly around his neck and something clutched in his hand.
"I heard someone saying your name on the stairs, Harry. Look what I've got here. I've had it developed. I wanted to show you."
Harry looked bemusedly at the photograph Colin was brandishing under his nose. A moving black-and-white Lockhart was tugging hard on an arm Harry recognized as his own. He was pleased to see that his photographic self was putting up a good fight and refusing to be dragged into view. As Harry watched, Lockhart gave up and slumped, panting, against the white edge of the picture.
"Will you sign it?" said Colin eagerly.
"No," said Harry flatly, glancing around to check that the room was really deserted. "Sorry, Colin, I'm in a hurry. Quidditch practice." He climbed through the portrait hole.
"Oh, wow! Wait for me. I've never watched a Quidditch game before."
Colin scrambled through the hole after him. "It'll be really boring," Harry said quickly, but Colin ignored him, his face shining with excitement.
"You were the youngest house player in 100 years, weren't you, Harry? Weren't you?"
said Colin, trotting alongside him.
"You must be brilliant. I've never flown. Is it easy? Is that your own broom? Is that the best one there is?"
Harry didn't know how to get rid of him. It was like having an extremely talkative shadow.
"I don't really understand Quidditch," said Colin breathlessly. "Is it true there are 4 balls, and 2 of them fly round trying to knock people off their brooms?"
"Yes," said Harry heavily, resigned to explaining the complicated rules of Quidditch. "They're called bludgers."
There are two beaters on each team who carry clubs to beat the bludgers away from their side. Fred and George Weasley are the Gryffindor beaters.
And what are the other balls for?
Colin asked, tripping down a couple of steps because he was gazing open-mouthed at Harry. Well, the Quaffle, that's the biggish red one, is the one that scores goals. Three chasers on each team throw the Quaffle to each other and try and get it through the goalposts at the end of the pitch. They're three long poles with hoops on the end.
And the fourth ball?
Is the Golden Snitch, said Harry, and it's very small, very fast and difficult to catch. But that's what the Seeker's got to do, because a game of Quidditch doesn't end until the Snitch has been caught, and whichever team's Seeker gets the Snitch earns his team an extra 150 points.
And you're Gryffindor Seeker, aren't you?
Said Colin in awe. Yes, said Harry, as they left the castle and started across the dew-drenched grass. And there's the Keeper, too. He guards the goalposts. That's it, really. But Colin didn't stop questioning Harry all the way down the sloping lawns to the Quidditch pitch, and Harry only shook him off when he reached the changing rooms. Colin called after him in a piping voice,
"I'll go and get a good seat, Harry,"
and hurried off to the stands. The rest of the Gryffindor team were already in the changing room. Wood was the only person who looked truly awake. Fred and George Weasley were sitting, puffy-eyed and tousle-haired, next to fourth-year Alicia Spinett, who seemed to be nodding off against the wall behind her. Her fellow chasers, Katie Bell and Angelina Johnson, were yawning side by side opposite them.
"There you are, Harry. What kept you?" said Wood briskly. "Now, I wanted a quick talk with you all before we actually get on to the pitch, because I spent the summer devising a whole new training programme, which I really think will make all the difference."
Wood was holding up a large diagram of a Quidditch pitch, on which were drawn many lines, arrows and crosses in different coloured inks. He took out his wand, tapped the board, and the arrows began to wiggle over the diagram like caterpillars. As Wood launched into a speech about his new tactics, Fred Weasley's head drooped right onto Alicia Spinett's shoulder, and he began to snore. The first board took nearly 20 minutes to explain, but there was another board under that, and a third under that one. Harry sank into a stupor as Wood droned on and on.
"So," said Wood at long last, jerking Harry from a wistful fantasy about what he could be eating for breakfast at this very moment up at the castle. "Is that clear? Any questions?"
"I've got a question, Oliver," said George, who had woken with a start. "Why couldn't you have told us all this yesterday when we were awake?" Wood wasn't pleased.
"Now listen here, you lot," he said, glowering at them all. "We should have won the Quidditch Cup last year. We're easily the best team, but unfortunately, owing to circumstances beyond our control—"
Harry shifted guiltily in his seat. He had been unconscious in the hospital wing for the final match of the previous year, meaning that Gryffindor had been a player short and had suffered their worst defeat in 300 years. Wood took a moment to regain control of himself. Their last defeat was clearly still torturing him.
"So, this year we train harder than ever before." "Okay, let's go and put our new theories into practice," Wood shouted, seizing his broomstick and leading the way out of the changing rooms. Stiff-legged and still yawning, his team followed.
They had been in the changing room so long that the sun was up properly now, although remnants of mist hung over the grass in the stadium. As Harry walked onto the pitch, he saw Ron and Hermione sitting in the stands.
"Aren't you finished yet?" called Ron, incredulously.
"Haven't even started," said Harry, looking jealously at the toast and marmalade Ron and Hermione had brought out of the great hall. "Wood's been teaching us new moves." He mounted his broomstick and kicked at the ground, soaring up into the air. The cool morning air whipped his face, waking him far more effectively than Wood's long talk. It felt wonderful to be back on the Quidditch pitch. He soared right around the stadium at full speed, racing Fred and George.
"What's that funny clicking noise?" called Fred as they hurtled around the corner.
Harry looked into the stands. Colin was sitting in one of the highest seats, his camera raised, taking picture after picture, the sound strangely magnified in the deserted stadium.
"Look this way, Harry! This way!"
he cried shrilly.
"Who's that?"
said Fred. "No idea," Harry lied, putting on a spurt of speed that took him as far away as possible from Colin.
"What's going on?" said Wood, frowning as he skimmed through the air towards them. "Why is that first year taking pictures? I don't like it. He could be a Slytherin spy, trying to find out about our new training program."
"He's in Gryffindor," said Harry, quickly.
"And the Slytherins don't need a spy, Oliver," said George. "What makes you say that?" said Wood, testily. "Because they're here in person," said George, pointing.
Several people in green robes were walking onto the pitch, broomsticks in their hands.
"I don't believe it!" Wood hissed in outrage. "I booked the pitch for today. We'll see about this!"
Wood shot towards the ground, landing rather harder than he meant to in his anger, staggering slightly as he dismounted. Harry, Fred and George followed.
"Flint!" Wood bellowed at the Slytherin captain. "This is our practice time. We got up specially. You can clear off now."
Marcus Flint was even larger than Wood. He had a look of trollish cunning on his face as he replied,
"Plenty of room for all of us, Wood."
Angelina, Alicia and Katie had come over too. There were no girls on the Slytherin team, who stood shoulder to shoulder, facing the Gryffindors, leering to a man.
"But I booked the pitch," said Wood, positively spitting with rage. "I booked it."
"Ah," said Flint. "But I've got a specially signed note here from Professor Snape. I, Professor S. Snape, give the Slytherin team permission to practice today on the Quidditch pitch, owing to the need to train their new seeker."
"You've got a new seeker?" said Wood, distracted. "Where?"
And from behind the six large figures before them came a seventh, smaller boy, smirking all over his pale, pointed face. It was Draco Malfoy.
"Aren't you Lucius Malfoy's son?" said Fred, looking at Malfoy with dislike. "Funny you should mention Draco's father," said Flint, as the whole Slytherin team smiled still more broadly. "Let me show you the generous gift he's made to the Slytherin team."
All seven of them held out their broomsticks. Seven highly polished, brand-new handles and seven sets of fine gold lettering spelling the words Nimbus 2001 gleamed under the Gryffindors' noses in the early morning sun.
"Very latest model. Only came out last month," said Flint carelessly, flicking a speck of dust from the end of his own. "I believe it outstrips the old 2000 series by a considerable amount. As for the old clean sweeps," he smiled nastily at Fred and George, who were both clutching clean sweep fives, "sweeps the board with them."
None of the Gryffindor team could think of anything to say for a moment. Malfoy was smirking so broadly his cold eyes were reduced to slits.
"Oh, look," said Flint, "a pitch invasion."
Ron and Hermione were crossing the grass to see what was going on.
"What's happening?" Ron asked Harry. "Why aren't you playing? And what's he doing here?"
He was looking at Malfoy, taking in his Slytherin Quidditch robes.
"I'm the new Slytherin seeker, Weasley," said Malfoy smugly. "Everyone's just been admiring the brooms my father's bought our team."
Ron gaped open-mouthed at the seven superb broomsticks in front of him.
"Good, aren't they?" said Malfoy smoothly. "But perhaps the Gryffindor team will be able to raise some gold and get new brooms too. You could raffle off those clean sweep fives. I expect a museum would bid for them." The Slytherin team howled with laughter.
"At least no one on the Gryffindor team had to buy their way in," said Hermione sharply. "They got in on pure talent."
The smug look on Malfoy's face flickered.
"No one asked your opinion, you filthy little mudblood," he spat.
Harry knew at once that Malfoy had said something really bad, because there was an instant uproar at his words. Flint had to dive in front of Malfoy to stop Fred and George jumping on him. Alicia shrieked,
"How dare you!"
And Ron plunged his hand into his robes, pulled out his wand, yelling,
"You'll pay for that one, Malfoy!"
and pointed it furiously under Flint's arm at Malfoy's face. A loud bang echoed around the stadium and a jet of green light shot out of the wrong end of Ron's wand, hitting him in the stomach and sending him reeling backwards onto the grass.
"Ron! Ron! Are you all right?"
squealed Hermione. Ron opened his mouth to speak, but no words came out. Instead, he gave an almighty belch, and several slugs dribbled out of his mouth onto his lap. The Slytherin team were paralysed with laughter. Flint was doubled up, hanging on to his new broomstick for support. Malfoy was on all fours, banging the ground with his fist.
The Gryffindors were gathered around Ron, who kept belching large, glistening slugs. Nobody seemed to want to touch him. "We'd better get him to Hagrid's. It's nearest," said Harry to Hermione, who nodded bravely, and the pair of them pulled Ron up by the arms.
"What happened, Harry? What happened? Is he ill? But you can cure him, can't you?"
Colin had run down from his seat and was now dancing alongside them as they left the pitch. Ron gave a huge heave, and more slugs dribbled down his front.
"Ooh!"
said Colin, fascinated, and raising his camera.
"Can you hold him still, Harry?"
"Get out of the way, Colin," said Harry angrily. He and Hermione supported Ron out of the stadium and across the grounds towards the edge of the forest.
"Nearly there, Ron,"
said Hermione, as the gamekeeper's cabin came into view. "You'll be all right in a minute. Almost there." They were within 20 feet of Hagrid's house when the front door opened. But it wasn't Hagrid who emerged. Gilderoy Lockhart, wearing robes of palest mauve today, came striding out.
"Quick, behind here!"
Harry hissed, dragging Ron behind a nearby bush. Hermione followed, somewhat reluctantly.
"It's a simple matter if you know what you're doing," Lockhart was saying loudly to Hagrid. "If you need help, you know where I am. I'll let you have a copy of my book. I'm surprised you haven't already got one. I'll sign one tonight and send it over. Well, goodbye."
And he strode away towards the castle. Harry waited until Lockhart was out of sight, then pulled Ron out of the bush and up to Hagrid's front door. They knocked urgently. Hagrid appeared at once, looking very grumpy, but his expression brightened when he saw who it was.
"Been wondering when you'd come to see me. Come in, come in. Thought you might have been Professor Lockhart back again."
Harry and Hermione supported Ron over the threshold into the one-roomed cabin, which had an enormous bed in one corner, a fire crackling merrily in the other. Hagrid didn't seem perturbed by Ron's slug problem, which Harry hastily explained as he lowered Ron into a chair.
"Better out than in," he said cheerfully, plunking a large copper basin in front of him. "Get them all up, Ron."
"I don't think there's anything to do except wait for it to stop,"
said Hermione anxiously, watching Ron bend over the basin.
"That's a difficult curse to work at the best of times, but with a broken wand—"
Hagrid was bustling around, making them tea. His boarhound, Fang, was slobbering over Harry. "What did Lockhart want with you, Hagrid?" Harry asked, scratching Fang's ears.
"Giving me advice on getting kelpies out of a well," growled Hagrid,
moving a half-plucked rooster off his scrubbed table and setting down the teapot.
"Like I don't know. And banging on about some banshee he banished. If one word of it was true, I'll eat my kettle."
It was most unlike Hagrid to criticise a Hogwarts teacher, and Harry looked at him in surprise. Hermione, however, said in a voice somewhat higher than usual,
"I think you're being a bit unfair. Professor Dumbledore obviously thought he was the best man for the job."
"He was the only man for the job,"
said Hagrid, offering them a plate of treacle fudge, while Ron coughed squelchily into his basin.
"And I mean the only one. Getting very difficult to find anyone for the dark arts job. People aren't too keen to take it on, see? They're starting to think it's jinxed. No one's lasted long for a while now. So, tell me,"
said Hagrid, jerking his head at Ron.
"Who was he trying to curse?"
Malfoy called Hermione something. It must have been really bad, because everyone went mad.
"It was bad,"
said Ron hoarsely, emerging over the tabletop, looking pale and sweaty. "Malfoy called her Mudblood. Hagrid..." Ron dived out of sight again as a fresh wave of slugs made their appearance. Hagrid looked outraged.
"He didn't,"
he growled at Hermione.
"He did," she said, "but I don't know what it means. I could tell it was really rude, of course."
"It's about the most insulting thing he could think of," gasped Ron, coming back up. "Mudblood's a really foul name for someone who was muggle-born, you know, non-magic parents. There are some wizards, like Malfoy's family, who think they're better than everyone else because they're what people call pure-blood."
He gave a small burp, and a single slug fell into his outstretched hand. He threw it into the basin and continued.
"I mean, the rest of us know it doesn't make any difference at all. Look at Neville Longbottom. He's pure blood, and he can hardly stand a cauldron the right way up." "And they haven't invented a spell our Hermione can't do," said Hagrid proudly, making Hermione go a brilliant shade of magenta.
"It's a disgusting thing to call someone," said Ron, wiping his sweaty brow with a shaking hand.
dirty blood, see? Common blood. It's mad. Most wizards these days are half-blood anyway. If we hadn't married muggles, we'd have died out. He retched and ducked out of sight again. "Well, I don't blame you for trying to curse him, Ron," said Hagrid loudly over the thuds of more slugs hitting the basin. "But maybe it was a good thing your wand backfired. Spec Lucius Malfoy would have come marching up to school if you'd cursed his son. Least you're not in trouble."
Harry would have pointed out that trouble didn't come much worse than having slugs pouring out of your mouth, but he couldn't. Hagrid's treacle toffee had cemented his jaws together.
"Harry!" said Hagrid suddenly, as though struck by a sudden thought. "Got a bone to pick with ye? I've heard you've been giving out signed photos. How come I haven't got one?"
Furious, Harry wrenched his teeth apart.
"I have not been giving out signed photos," he said hotly. "If Lockhart's still putting that about—"
But then he saw that Hagrid was laughing.
"I'm only joking," he said,
patting Harry genially on the back and sending him face first into the table.
"I knew you hadn't really. I told Lockhart you didn't need to. You're more famous than him without trying."
"Betty didn't like that," said Harry, sitting up and rubbing his chin.
"Don't think he did," said Hagrid, his eyes twinkling. "And then I told him I'd never read one of his books, and he decided to go. Treacle toffee, Ron,"
he added as Ron reappeared. "No, thanks," said Ron weakly. "Better not risk it."
"Come and see what I've been growing,"
said Hagrid, as Harry and Hermione finished the last of their tea. In the small vegetable patch behind Hagrid's house were a dozen of the largest pumpkins Harry had ever seen. Each was the size of a large boulder.
"Getting on well, aren't they?" said Hagrid happily. "For the Halloween feast. Should be big enough by then."
"What have you been feeding them?" said Harry. Hagrid looked over his shoulder to check that they were alone.
"Well, I've been giving them, you know, a bit of help."
Harry noticed Hagrid's flowery pink umbrella leaning against the back wall of the cabin. Harry had had reason to believe before now that this umbrella was not all it looked. In fact, he had the strong impression that Hagrid's old school wand was concealed inside it. Hagrid wasn't supposed to use magic. He had been expelled from Hogwarts in his third year, but Harry had never found out why. Any mention of the matter, and Hagrid would clear his throat loudly and become mysteriously deaf until the subject was changed.
"An engorgement charm, I suppose," said Hermione, halfway between disapproval and amusement. "Well, you've done a good job on them."
"That's what your little sister said," said Hagrid, nodding at Ron. "Met her just yesterday."
Hagrid looked sideways at Harry, his beard twitching.
"Said she was just looking round the grounds, but I reckon she was hoping she might run into someone else at my house."
He winked at Harry.
"If you ask me, she wouldn't say no to a signed—"
"Oh, shut up!" said Harry. Ron snorted with laughter, and the ground was sprayed with slugs.
"Watch it!" Hagrid roared, pulling Ron away from his precious pumpkins.
It was nearly lunchtime, and as Harry had only had one bit of treacle fudge since dawn, he was keen to go back to school to eat. They said goodbye to Hagrid and walked back up to the castle, Ron hiccupping occasionally, but only bringing up two very small slugs. They had barely set foot in the cool entrance hall when a voice rang out.
"There you are, Potter. Weasley."
Professor McGonagall was walking towards them, looking stern.
"You will both do your detentions this evening."
"What are we doing, Professor?" said Ron, nervously suppressing a burp.
"You will be polishing the silver in the trophy room with Mr. Filch," said Professor McGonagall. "And no magic, Weasley. Elbow grease."
Ron gulped. Argus Filch, the caretaker, was loathed by every student in the school.
"And you, Potter, will be helping Professor Lockhart answer his fan mail," said Professor McGonagall. "Oh, no! Can't I go and do the trophy room too?" said Harry desperately.
"Certainly not," said Professor McGonagall, raising her eyebrows. "Professor Lockhart requested you particularly. 8 o'clock sharp, both of you." Harry and Ron slouched into the great hall in states of deepest gloom, Hermione behind them, wearing a "well-you-did-break-school-rules" sort of expression. Harry didn't fancy his shepherd's pie as much as he'd thought. Both he and Ron felt they'd got the worst deal.
"Filch'll have me there all night," said Ron heavily. "No magic. There must be about 100 cups in that room. I'm no good at muggle cleaning."
"I'd swap any time," said Harry hollowly.
I've had loads of practice with the Dursleys. Answering Lockhart's fan mail. He'll be a nightmare. Saturday afternoon seemed to melt away, and in what seemed like no time it was 8:05, and Harry was dragging his feet along the second-floor corridor to Lockhart's office. He gritted his teeth and knocked. The door flew open at once. Lockhart beamed down at him. "Ah-ha, here's the scallywag," he said. "Come in, Harry, come in." Shining brightly on the walls by the light of many candles were countless framed photographs of Lockhart. He had even signed a few of them. Another large pile lay on his desk. "You can address the envelopes," Lockhart told Harry, as though this was a huge treat. "This first one's to Gladys Gudgeon, bless her. Huge fan of mine." The minutes snailed by. Harry let Lockhart's voice wash over him, occasionally saying, and "right," and "yeah." Now and then he caught a phrase like, "Fame's a fickle friend, Harry," or "Celebrity is as celebrity does, remember that." The candles burned lower and lower, making the light dance over the many moving faces of Lockhart watching him. Harry moved his aching hand over what felt like the 1,000th envelope, writing out Veronica Smedley's address. "It must be nearly time to leave," Harry thought miserably. "Please let it be nearly time." And then he heard something. Something quite apart from the spitting of the dying candles and Lockhart's prattle about his fans. It was a voice. A voice to chill the bone marrow. A voice of breathtaking, ice-cold venom. "Come. Come to me. Let me rip you. Let me tear you. Let me kill you." Harry gave a huge jump, and a large lilac blot appeared on Veronica Smedley's street. "What?" he said loudly. "I know," said Lockhart. 6 solid months at the top of the bestseller list. Broke all records." "No," said Harry frantically. "That voice!" "Sorry?" said Lockhart, looking puzzled. "What voice?" "That voice that said... Didn't you hear it?" Lockhart was looking at Harry in high astonishment. "What are you talking about, Harry? Perhaps you're getting a little drowsy. Great Scott, look at the time! We've been here nearly 4 hours. I'd never have believed it. The time's flown, hasn't it?" Harry didn't answer. He was straining his ears to hear the voice again. But there was no sound now except for Lockhart telling him he mustn't expect a treat like this every time he got detention. Feeling dazed, Harry left. It was so late that the Gryffindor common room was almost empty. Harry went straight up to the dormitory. Ron wasn't back yet. Harry pulled on his pyjamas, got into bed, and waited. 30 minutes later, Ron arrived, nursing his right arm and bringing a strong smell of polish into the darkened room. "My muscles have all seized up," he groaned, sinking on his bed. 14 times he made me buff up that Quidditch cup before he was satisfied. And then I had another slug attack all over a special award for services to the school. Took ages to shift the slime. How was it with Lockhart?" Keeping his voice low so as not to wake Neville, Dean and Seamus, Harry told Ron exactly what he had heard.
"And Lockhart said he couldn't hear it," said Ron.
Harry could see him frowning in the moonlight.
"Do you think he was lying? I don't get it. Even someone invisible would have had to open the door."
"I know," said Harry, lying back in his four-poster and staring at the canopy above him. "I don't get it either." Chapter 8. The Death Day Party. October arrived, spreading a damp chill over the grounds and into the castle. Madame Pomfrey, the matron, was kept busy by a sudden spate of colds among the staff and students. Her pepper-up potion worked instantly, though it left the drinker smoking at the ears for several hours afterwards. Ginny Weasley, who had been looking peaky, was bullied into taking some by Percy. The steam, pouring from under her vivid hair, gave the impression that her whole head was on fire. Raindrops the size of bullets thundered on the castle windows for days on end,
the lake rose, the flower beds turned into muddy streams, and Hagrid's pumpkins swelled to the size of garden sheds. Oliver Wood's enthusiasm for regular training sessions, however, was not dampened, which was why Harry was to be found late one stormy Saturday afternoon a few days before Halloween, returning to Gryffindor Tower, drenched to the skin and splattered with mud. Even aside from the rain and wind, it hadn't been a happy practice session. Fred and George, who had been spying on the Slytherin team, had seen for themselves the speed of those new Nimbus 2001s. They reported that the Slytherin team were no more than seven greenish blurs shooting through the air like jump jets. As Harry squelched along the deserted corridor, he came across somebody who looked just as preoccupied as he was. Nearly headless Nick, the ghost of Gryffindor Tower, was staring morosely out of a window, muttering under his breath, "Don't fulfil their requirements. Half an inch, if that." "Hello, Nick," said Harry.
"Hello, oh, hello,"
said nearly headless Nick, starting and looking round. He wore a dashing plumed hat on his long, curly hair, and a tunic with a ruff, which concealed the fact that his neck was almost completely severed. He was pale as smoke, and Harry could see right through him to the dark sky and torrential rain outside.
"You look troubled, young Potter," said Nick,
folding a transparent letter as he spoke and tucking it inside his doublet. "So do you," said Harry.
"Ah," nearly headless Nick waved an elegant hand, "a matter of no importance. It's not as though I really wanted to join. Thought I'd apply, but apparently I don't fulfil requirements."
In spite of his airy tone, there was a look of great bitterness on his face.
"But you would think, wouldn't you?"
he erupted suddenly, pulling the letter back out of his pocket,
"that getting hit 45 times in the neck with a blunt axe would qualify you to join the Headless Hunt."
"Oh, yes," said Harry, who was obviously supposed to agree.
"I mean, nobody wishes more than I do that it had all been quick and clean and my head had come off properly. I mean, it would have saved me a great deal of pain and ridicule. However..."
Nearly headless Nick shook his letter open and read furiously.
"We can only accept huntsmen whose heads have parted company with their bodies. You will appreciate that it would be impossible otherwise for members to participate in hunt activities such as horseback head-juggling and head-polo. It is with the greatest regret, therefore, that I must inform you that you do not fulfil our requirements. With very best wishes, Sir Patrick Delaney Podmore."
Fuming, nearly headless Nick stuffed the letter away.
"Half an inch of skin and sinew holding my neck on, Harry. Most people would think that's good and beheaded, but oh no, it's not enough for Sir Properly Decapitated Podmore."
Nearly headless Nick took several deep breaths and then said, in a far calmer tone,
"So, what's bothering you? Anything I can do?"
"No," said Harry. "Not unless you know where we can get seven free Nimbus 2001s for our match against The rest of Harry's sentence was drowned by a high-pitched mewing from somewhere near his ankles. He looked down and found himself gazing into a pair of lamp-like yellow eyes. It was Mrs. Norris, the skeletal grey cat who was used by the caretaker, Argus Filch, as a sort of deputy in his endless battle against students.
"You'd better get out of here, Harry," said Nick quickly. "Filch isn't in a good mood. He's got flu and some third years accidentally plastered frog brains all over the ceiling in Dungeon 5. He's been cleaning all morning, and if he sees you dripping mud all over the place..."
"Right," said Harry, backing away from the accusing stare of Mrs. Norris, but not quickly enough. Drawn to the spot by the mysterious power that seemed to connect him with his foul cat, Argus Filch burst suddenly through a tapestry to Harry's right, wheezing and looking wildly about for the rule-breaker. There was a thick tartan scarf bound around his head, and his nose was unusually purple.
"Filth!"
he shouted, his jowls a-quiver, his eyes popping alarmingly as he pointed at the muddy puddle that had dripped from Harry's Quidditch robes.
"Mess and muck everywhere! I've had enough of it, I tell you! Follow me, Potter!"
So Harry waved a gloomy goodbye to nearly headless Nick and followed Filch back downstairs, doubling the number of muddy footprints on the floor. Harry had never been inside Filch's office before. It was a place most students avoided. The room was dingy and windowless, lit by a single oil lamp dangling from the low ceiling. A faint smell of fried fish lingered about the place. Wooden filing cabinets stood around the walls. From their labels, Harry could see that they contained details of every pupil Filch had ever punished. Fred and George Weasley had an entire drawer to themselves. A highly polished collection of chains and manacles hung on the wall behind Filch's desk. It was common knowledge that he was always begging Dumbledore to let him suspend students by their ankles from the ceiling. Filch grabbed a quill from a pot on his desk and began shuffling around looking for parchment.
"Dung!" he muttered furiously. "Great sizzling dragon bogies! Frog brains! Rat intestines! I've had enough of it! Make an example! Where's the form? Yes."
He retrieved a large roll of parchment from his desk drawer and stretched it out in front of him, dripping his long black quill into the inkpot.
"Name, Harry Potter. Crime."
"It was only a bit of mud," said Harry.
"It's only a bit of mud to you, boy, but to me it's an extra hour scrubbing," shouted Filch, a drip shivering unpleasantly at the end of his bulbous nose. "Crime? Befouling the castle. Suggested sentence?"
Dabbing at his streaming nose, Filch squinted unpleasantly at Harry, who waited with bated breath for his sentence to fall. But as Filch lowered his quill, there was a great bang on the ceiling of the office, which made the oil lamp rattle.
"Peeves!" Filch roared, flinging down his quill in a transport of rage. "I'll have you this time, I'll have you!"
And without a backwards glance at Harry, Filch ran flat-footed from the office, Mrs. Norris streaking alongside him. Peeves was the school poltergeist, a grinning, airborne menace who lived to cause havoc and distress. Harry didn't much like Peeves, but couldn't help feeling grateful for his timing. Hopefully, whatever Peeves had done, and it sounded as though he'd wrecked something very big this time, would distract Filch from Harry. Thinking that he should probably wait for Filch to come back, Harry sank into a moth-eaten chair next to the desk. There was only one thing on it, apart from his half-completed form, a large, glossy, purple envelope with silver lettering on the front. With a quick glance at the door to check that Filch wasn't on his way back, Harry picked up the envelope and read, "Quickspell, a correspondence course in beginner's magic." Intrigued, Harry flicked the envelope open and pulled out the sheaf of parchment inside. More curly silver writing on the front page said, "Feel out of step in the world of modern magic. Find yourself making excuses not to perform simple spells. Ever been taunted for your woeful wand work? There is an answer. Quickspell is an all-new fail-safe quick result easy-learn course. Hundreds of witches and wizards have benefited from the Quickspell method. Madam Zed Nettles of Topsham writes, 'I had no memory for incantations and my potions were a family joke. Now, after a Quickspell course, I am the centre of attention at parties, and friends beg for the recipe of my scintillation solution.' Warlock DJ Prod of Didsbury says, 'My wife used to sneer at my feeble charms, but 1 month into your fabulous Quickspell course, I succeeded in turning her into a yak. Thank you, Quickspell.'" Fascinated, Harry thumbed through the rest of the envelope's contents. Why on earth did Filch want a Quickspell course? Did this mean he wasn't a proper wizard? Harry was just reading Lesson 1, Holding Your Wand, Some Useful Tips, when shuffling footsteps outside told him Filch was coming back. Stuffing the parchment back into the envelope, Harry threw it back onto the desk just as the door opened. Filch was looking triumphant.
"That vanishing cabinet was extremely valuable," he was saying gleefully to Mrs. Norris. "We'll have Peeves out this time, my sweet."
His eyes fell on Harry and then darted to the Quickspell envelope, which, Harry realized too late, was lying 2 feet away from where it had started. Filch's pasty face went brick red. Harry braced himself for a tidal wave of fury. Filch hobbled across to his desk, snatched up the envelope and threw it into a drawer.
Did you read?" he spluttered.
"No," Harry lied quickly. Filch's knobbly hands were twisting together.
"If I thought you'd read my private... Not that it's mine, for a friend, be that as it may, however..."
Harry was staring at him, alarmed. Filch had never looked madder. His eyes were popping. A tick was going in one of his pouchy cheeks, and the tartan scarf didn't help.
"Very well. Go. And don't breathe a word. Not that... However, if you didn't read... Go now. I have to write up Peeves' report. Go!"
Amazed at his luck, Harry sped out of the office, up the corridor and back upstairs. To escape from Filch's office without punishment was probably some kind of school record.
"Harry! Harry! Did it work?"
Nearly headless Nick came gliding out of a classroom. Behind him, Harry could see the wreckage of a large black-and-gold cabinet, which appeared to have been dropped from a great height.
"I persuaded Peeves to crash it right over Filch's office," said Nick eagerly. "Thought it might distract him."
"Was that you?" said Harry gratefully.
"Yeah, it worked. I didn't even get detention.
Thanks, Nick." They set off up the corridor together. Nearly headless Nick, Harry noticed, was still holding Sir Patrick's rejection letter.
"I wish there was something I could do for you about the headless hunt," Harry said.
Nearly headless Nick stopped in his tracks, and Harry walked right through him. He wished he hadn't. It was like stepping through an icy shower.
"But there is something you could do for me," said Nick excitedly.
"Harry, would I be asking too much? But no, you wouldn't want..."
"What is it?" said Harry.
"Well, this Halloween will be my 500th death day," said nearly headless Nick, drawing himself up and looking dignified.
"Oh," said Harry, not sure whether he should look sorry or happy about this. "Right.
I'm holding a party down in one of the roomier dungeons. Friends will be coming from all over the country. It would be such an honour if you would attend. Mr. Weasley and Miss Granger would be most welcome too, of course, but I dare say you'd rather go to the school feast."
He watched Harry on tenterhooks.
"No," said Harry quickly. "I'll come."
"My dear boy, Harry Potter at my death day party! And," he hesitated, looking excited, "do you think you could possibly mention to Sir Patrick how very frightening and impressive you find me?"
Of course," said Harry.
Nearly headless Nick beamed at him.
"A death day party?"
said Hermione keenly, when Harry had changed at last and joined her and Ron in the common room.
"I bet there aren't many living people who can say they've been to one of those. It'll be fascinating."
"Why would anyone want to celebrate the day they died?" said Ron, who was halfway through his potions homework and grumpy. "Sounds dead depressing to me." Rain was still lashing the windows, which were now inky black. But inside, all looked bright and cheerful. The firelight glowed over the countless squashy armchairs where people sat reading, talking, doing homework, or, in the case of Fred and George Weasley, trying to find out what would happen if you fed a filibuster firework to a salamander. Fred had rescued the brilliant orange fire-dwelling lizard from a Care of Magical Creatures class, and it was now smouldering gently on a table, surrounded by a knot of curious people. Harry was on the point of telling Ron and Hermione about Filch and the quickspell course when the salamander suddenly whizzed into the air, emitting loud sparks and bangs as it whirled wildly round the room. The sight of Percy bellowing himself hoarse at Fred and George, the spectacular display of tangerine stars showering from the salamander's mouth and its escape into the fire with accompanying explosions, drove both Filch and the quickspell envelope from Harry's mind.